Now, last week, we got through talking about Noah, his person and his mission. And we said that Noah's father, when he was born, said, "This man, this one will comfort us concerning the work and toil of our hands." The name Noah means comfort. Right? It means comfort. Then we learn from 2 Peter that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. He wasn't just a boat builder. He was a preacher of righteousness, and the building of the ark was a sign of the coming judgment of God. Then in Hebrews 11, we learned that what motivated Noah was not his personal holiness or personal worthiness, but that he became the heir of the righteousness which is by faith. That is, the thing that made Noah different from everybody else is that he put his faith in the Lord and in the Lord's word, while the whole rest of the world went its own sinful way. All right, so it's important to note, Noah was not a superior human being to anybody else, really. He was simply a man of faith in a world filled with unbelief. All right, so that's important to grasp. Then finally, we mentioned that in Genesis chapter 7, verse 1, it says, God says to Noah, "Come, thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation." Now, the words there are very important. Notice that God doesn't say, "You are the only righteous person in this generation." He says, "You have I seen righteous in this generation." Right? And that the whole idea is not what you are in yourself, but how God looks at you. That's the difference. See, people don't understand that. They think that righteousness is all about me and what I do and what I abstain from doing. But real righteousness is not that, right? Real righteousness is, what does God say of you? How does He regard you? Later on in the book of Genesis, it will say of Abraham, he believed God, and God reckoned it to him for righteousness. That is, Abraham's faith was considered righteousness in the eyes of God. Justification by faith, right? So that there are many people who live in the world who outwardly to other people appear to live an exemplary life. You know, we look at people who do great things and we appreciate them, and their work in this world is very valuable, and we're thankful for good people, you know, in the earthly sense. We don't despise that. Right? But those things do not commend us to God. What commends us to God is how we respond to His word. Do we respond in unbelief, or do we respond in faith? And if we respond in faith, that is our righteousness before God. So, thee have I seen righteous. The message there being that what matters is not how you are, but how God regards you. Very important. Alright, now, we started talking about Genesis 6, verse 1. Alright? And let's just go on from there. So, and it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Right? And I think I touched upon last week the idea that this is not talking about demons coming down from heaven and impregnating women and giving birth to a race of changelings, or, you know, the way you'd see it in the movies, right? The sons of God were the descendants of Seth, the son of Adam who replaced Abel. Remember, God had Cain and Abel, and Cain murdered Abel. And then later on, God had another son in the place of Abel, Seth. Abel and Seth were righteous believers in the Lord and His Word. Cain was not. He was an impenitent, unbelieving murderer. Right? So when it says here, the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them for wives, what this means is that the godly descendants of Seth intermarried with the unbelieving descendants of Cain. And as a result of this, they diluted the spiritual stock of the human race. Alright? You know, and you can see this in life. When you have a believer marries an unbeliever, it is usually the fact that the unbeliever pulls the believer down. It is seldom the fact that the believer lifts the unbeliever up. Why is that? Because the unbeliever is not moved by the Holy Spirit, and therefore is not susceptible normally to spiritual impulses. And so very often you'll see, like, for example, somebody will marry somebody that's not a believer, but they'll paper over the mistake by saying, but, you know, I'm praying for him, or I'm praying for her, and, you know, hopefully they will come to the Lord and be saved. And Sometimes that happens. Most of the time, it does not. And so you end up with a divided family. Right? You have a believer, and you have an unbeliever. And in the most important thing in life, they are not united. And it's a dissolution, right? There's no spiritual strength there. And, you know, very often the believers who have married an unbeliever, you know, after a number of years of trying and cajoling and begging and pleading, they finally just give up. And, you know, the unbeliever does his thing or her thing, and the believer does his or her thing. And you know, if you can get a person to be honest, they will often say, I should have paid attention to my parents and not married an unbeliever. You know, so... Now, that doesn't mean that a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever is not valid. It's a marriage, right? It's a marriage, and it's a real marriage, right? But it is a marriage that shouldn't take place, right? Because in the most important thing, the most important thing in life, there is division. And that cannot bode well. Now, some people would like to disagree with me and say, oh, you know, I have an example of a person who married an unbeliever and they have a wonderful family and a wonderful life together. Yeah, I'm not saying that it's not possible to have a good life. But what I'm saying is there is a fundamental disconnect right at the core. Right? And as outwardly good as a marriage might be, when you're laying in bed at night next to your unbelieving spouse, or your unbelieving spouse is laying next to their believing spouse, there is a realization. You know, on the one hand, the unbeliever wishes his or her spouse wasn't so darn religious. You know, she's really great. She's just a pain in the neck with this religion business, right? Or the believer, you know, lays there in bed at night sorrowing and praying for the unbeliever, you know. And so there, right at the core, there is a lack of unity there. Now, some people handle that well, and despite that, they have a relatively good life. But it involves compromises where there should be no compromise. Right. Anyway, we'll move on. So you understand, if you're ever watching YouTube and you come across these videos about demons impregnating human women and giving birth to a race of changelings, see it for what it's worth. The Bible doesn't teach that. The sons of God are the descendants of Seth, and the daughters of men are the Cainites. And what these two different groups of people did was they intermarried and they diluted the spiritual power of the human race. All right. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he is also flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. So essentially what God is saying here is, I'm not going to fight with these people forever. I'm going to give them 120 years and that's it. Alright, so this is time to repent. His years shall be 120 years. Then it says in verse 4, there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Alright, what does this mean? Giants. The Hebrew word is Nephilim. Nephilim, and it means giants. That's simply what it means. We read about, in when you get into the books of Samuel and Kings, you read about Goliath, right, who was 9 feet tall, right, more than 9 feet tall, and it describes the size of his spear, and he was a giant. But there were in Israel, and if you want to look up the words, you know, there's Nephilim, there's Anakim, and there's Zuzim, and other words in the Old Testament that talk about people who lived in certain areas who were very large. Even to this day, in certain parts of the world, we have people who are much taller than the rest. I'm thinking of, what's that tribe in Africa? the very tall ones. I can't remember the name, but you know, they average about 8+ feet tall. And so the idea that there were giants in the earth does not mean that there was fee-fi-fo-fum gigantic 50-foot tall people. That's not what it means. It means in a world in which the average person was about 5'6", these people were like 8 to 9 feet tall, and they were giants. Right? And so among the people in the earth in those days were people of large stature. And as often happens with big, strong people, these people become notable and influential. Alright? The big, strong, invincible guy is the guy that everybody looks at and says, "You are king." Right? So when it says there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men bare them children, they became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. All right, so these were the famous patriarchs of the ancient times. And then it says in verse 5, "And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." All right, this is God's verdict as he looks down from heaven upon the world of human beings at this time. And he sees, and this is very strong language, "The wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continuously." Why? Because men were living in unbelief. They had rejected God. They had rejected the word of God. Therefore, they only had their own opinions to go on. And guess what happens when we have nothing but our own opinions to go on? We corrupt ourselves. And we pay attention to our impulses rather than to our better judgment. And we end up becoming corrupt. And because we don't like to think of ourselves as corrupt, what we do is we then change our perspective so that things that we once thought of as wicked or evil, we now suddenly realize these things aren't wicked at all, but they're actually good. Right? And you see this in our modern culture. You see that if you could go in a time machine, not back to the 1800s, but back to 1960, all right, when I was a 7-year-old boy, 1960, you would be utterly shocked at the world that existed. That even people who didn't go to church at all agreed that things that we accept as good now were horrible, you know, and it would shock you and jar you to see how far our culture has fallen since 1960. In 1960, we were not pillars of spiritual strength in 1960 either. Right? But compared to now, right, when we look at things that are patently bad, patently destructive, patently unhelpful, and we say, these things are not only good, they're wonderful, and we have to celebrate them. and have parades about them. So that's how does that kind of happen? Well, it happens because human beings, we love to sin, right? But we don't like to think of ourselves as sinners. So we got these two things going on. We love sin, but we don't like to think of ourselves that way. So what we do is we change the rules and we begin to think about sin in a different way. Right? And so, back in 1960, just to give you one example, back in 1960, if you got a divorce, you were a bum. You were somebody to be avoided. Nobody would say it to your face, but nobody really wanted to hang around with you. Nobody would ask you to babysit for their children. All right? Why? Because you got a divorce. All right? And it was considered evil to get a divorce. It was bad. Yeah, sometimes in rare circumstances, you know, a divorce was inevitable. But divorce was rare, and it was frowned upon. And so if you were not happy with your spouse, you sucked it up, and you increased your hope of heaven, right? You stayed married, and you dealt with it, because marriage is about more than just you. Marriage is about the culture. Because as the family goes, so goes the culture. You break up and harm the family structure, and it has a negative impact on society. Because society stems from the family. Right? It's Adam and Eve, and then the rest of the world. And it's the family, and then the community, and then the government and the nation. Right? So if the family is destroyed, and that's why the devil is working overtime in our modern day and age to destroy the family. Right? He's doing that in order to destroy the culture and to destroy the nation. Right? And So, take that for what it's worth. So, God saw the wickedness that was great in the earth, and every evil, every imagination of the thoughts of his hearts was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man in the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. So God makes a judgment, and he determines that he is going to destroy the world as it then existed. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Right? So the whole human race was filled with unbelief and sin. And Noah was pretty much alone in faith and godliness. Right? So we shouldn't be surprised if we are called upon to be that Noah in this generation. That is, to be the one who says no to the world's unbelief, no to the world's wicked behavior, and says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. All right, so God decides, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Grace means undeserved favor. Undeserved favor. That's what grace means. So Noah is saved by grace, not by works. He's saved by grace. The works that Noah did were the fruit or the result of his faith. First he had faith, then he did what God wanted him to do. All right, but it begins with faith. Works are the result of faith. All right, now, I just wanted to, I didn't want to read the whole thing about the flood because it's long. But I just wanted to highlight a few key verses in the flood story so we can kind of summarize it. And we begin with chapter 7, Genesis 7:16. And they that went in male and female of all flesh, as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. Right, now, there's a number of things that we need to be reminded of. Noah didn't have to go scootling around the bushes looking for two animals of every kind. The animals came to Noah according to the will of God and the direction of God. Noah simply had to receive them into the ark. Alright, and then it says that when all the creatures that were going to be saved, and Noah and his family, when they were in the ark, the Lord shut them in. And what that means is this. It was not really the ark in and of itself that saved Noah. It was that the ark was the chosen instrument of the Lord by which he saved Noah. All right? That's an important distinction to make. Because as violent as the flood was, any man-made ship would have been destroyed. Right? However, God's special blessing and protection was upon this vessel which he commanded to be built. All right? And he promised would save them from the flood. Now, let's talk briefly about the flood and the ark. Noah and his family represent Christian believers. The ark represents the church. And the waters of the flood represent holy baptism. Right? And we'll see this later on. The big punchline of the whole story is this connection that you have Noah, the ark, and the waters of the flood. And now you have baptism, which corresponds to the waters of the flood that now saves you. We'll talk about that more, but I just wanted to give you a little hint of that. All right, so the Lord shut him in. Now in 7:23, and every living substance was destroyed which is upon the face of the ground, both man and cattle and creeping things and the fowl of the heavens. And they were destroyed from the earth. And Noah only remained alive, and they that were with him in the ark. Alright? So all the creatures of the land were destroyed. Doesn't say that the fish and the sea creatures were destroyed. But it says that all the creatures upon the land were destroyed, and only Noah and the inhabitants of the ark were saved. Alright, so the flood was a worldwide cataclysm. Alright, and the other thing that many people don't realize about the flood, it wasn't simply a matter of rain coming down from the sky. It says all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. And so there are several causes to the flood. All the reservoirs of subterranean waters gave forth all of the seismic activity that changed the topography of the world. Remember, you have to think of the world before the flood as being very different than the world as it was when the flood was over. Right? So it wasn't just that, you know, the flood wasn't this. It wasn't that one day it started to rain and slowly the world filled up with water. That's a cartoon. All right? What happened was that the earth went into a convulsion of seismic and plate tectonic activity. And water spouted out from the subterranean depths, and waters, due to seismic activities, came flying out of the basins, like in the oceans and everything, and all of this water began to run around the world. Alright, so it's almost like God took hold of the earth on the north and south pole and went like this. And the whole world just went, whoa! That's what happened to the world. It was not suddenly raining, and the rain keeps getting deeper, and we're all looking out at the ark and watching people drown. That's not what it was. This thing was a cataclysm, right? That essentially God just knocked the world off its kilter. And the result was that all the waters in the ocean started spinning around the world, and the whole world became an ocean, right? And so
the flood was not a gentle thing. It was something that when the flood was over, the world was an entirely different place, right? Verse Genesis chapter 8. And God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the cattle that was with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters assuaged. The fountains also of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained, and the waters returned from off the earth continually. And after the end of 150 days, the waters were abated, and the ark rested in the seventh month on the seventh day of the month upon the mountains of Ararat. And the waters decreased continually until the tenth month, and in the tenth month, on the first day of the month, were the tops of the mountains seen. And then the Bible goes on to describe that the waters keep going down, 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 down. And finally, Noah opens up the roof of the ark, and he begins to send birds out to see when it was that they don't come back. And finally, after a year and 10 days, right, they leave the ark. So the whole time that Noah was in the ark was a year and 10 days. And then the door was opened and out they came. Alright. So that's the flood. The flood was a judgment of God upon a wicked world. And the flood is a foretaste of the day of judgment. Alright? And we see this when we look at how Jesus talks about the flood. So let's look at Luke 17, verse 26. Jesus said, "And as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, And the flood came and destroyed them all. Now notice here, just as a side note, Jesus, the Son of God, who could look into your heart and know your thoughts, he's God incarnate. Jesus accepted the book of Genesis at face value. Notice, Jesus doesn't indicate in any way that the story of the flood is some kind of myth or some kind of legend. He simply accepts it and speaks about it as if it were news, right? As if it were something that happened. Therefore, when you see Christians in their cringing, faithless desire to compromise, and they say, well, you know, maybe the flood is a metaphor for, you know, and they get and go off in that, or they say, maybe the flood was just a local thing, you know, a local little flood between the Tigris and Euphrates River, and maybe there was a guy who built a boat and blah, 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 but there certainly was no worldwide flood. But, now, if there wasn't a worldwide flood, and Jesus being the Son of God without sin, if he knew that, why would he say there was? Right? And so the fact that Jesus here, as he does when he talks about marriage, and he says, it was not so from the beginning when, you know, when man and the wife were brought together and the two became one flesh, Jesus accepts the account of Genesis as genuine, reliable history. And he doesn't give us any reason to doubt the historicity of the book of Genesis. Jesus understands, and he's the Son of God. So if the Son of God can accept these things, so can we. All right. The only reason that we feel a need to reinterpret these things is because we feel intimidated by the unbelief of our culture. And because our culture uses things that it uses in order to intimidate and to convince us that their version of things is true. I'll give you just one example. The whole dinosaur thing. You ever notice how little kids are force-fed dinosaur stuff? Right? And there's dinosaur this and dinosaur that. And you know, if your kids learn one thing in elementary school that they remember, it's dinosaurs. Right? But nobody ever tells them that all the Jurassic Park nonsense and all of the actual stuff that we really know about dinosaurs is only about 1/10 or 1/100 of what we don't know. So, dinosaurs. We don't really know much about dinosaurs at all. Right? We don't necessarily really even know what they look like. Like when you go to the Museum of Natural History and you see that dinosaur skeleton, you do realize, of course, that that thing is made out of plaster of Paris. There are no dinosaur bones in that. All right? That is an artist's rendition of what we think dinosaurs look like. And very often, the whole dinosaur is constructed from little more than a jawbone or a tooth. And an entire... Do you know that Tyrannosaurus Rex, for example? Look at Tyrannosaurus Rex. He's got that gigantic head. He's got those tiny little arms like this. You know, Tyrannosaurus Rex? Do you realize that if Tyrannosaurus Rex really looked like that,
If that was an accurate portrait of what he was, he wouldn't have been able to shield himself from a fall. And if Tyrannosaurus, with the size of his head, with regard to the rest of his body, and the fact that his hands were virtually useless, if he fell on the ground, he would basically become unconscious. He would knock himself out because the strength of that heavy head hitting the ground would basically render him unconscious. Right? In other words, we know a good deal about these dinosaurs, but a lot of what we know is not really knowledge, it is supposition. Right? And so, you know, all that Jurassic Park stuff and all those reconstructions and those artistic things, you watch these films and documentaries about the dinosaur. And for example, the one thing that they say, nowadays is that dinosaurs went extinct because a comet or an asteroid hit the Earth, right? You ever hear that? Dinosaur or an asteroid hit the Earth. But did you know that 80% of all scientists don't believe that at all? There's about 50 different opinions about why the dinosaurs went extinct, and nobody knows why they went extinct. Right? Nobody knows, but everybody has an opinion. And yet your kids are taught, oh yes, 50 billion years ago, or 50 million years ago, whatever it is, an asteroid or a comet hit the Earth and all the dinosaurs went extinct. That's just an opinion. But they don't tell you it's an opinion. Anyway, Jesus took this at face value. All right? So shall it be in the coming of the Son of Man. Noah entered the ark. The flood came and destroyed them all. Now there's a parallel passage to this in Matthew 24. But as in the days of Noah, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. So you see here that twice we read of Jesus using the flood, which he accepted at face value, using it as a warning connected to the second coming of Christ. Now, finally, we get to the last part here. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. For Christ also hath once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but quickened by the Spirit. By which he also went and preached unto the spirits in prison. All right, well that's referring to what we say in the Apostles' Creed when we say he was crucified, dead, and buried. He descended into hell. All right? So Christ went and preached to the spirits in prison. What was the content of his sermon? It was basically, I win, you lose. All right. Once you're in hell, there's no getting out. So when Jesus went to preach to the spirits in prison, he went to proclaim his victory over sin, death, and the devil to his enemies. All right. So he went and he preached to the spirits in prison, which were at one time disobedient, when once the long suffering of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was a preparing. All right, so while God was being patient, waiting for Noah to finish building the ark. All right, and meanwhile, the world was living in disobedience. All right, disobedience to God, and God was being patient. Wherein few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water. Eight souls were saved by water. The like figure,
Whereunto even baptism doth also now save us. Not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is on the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers being made subject unto him. And I gave a modern translation of verse 21. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves us. Not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but the question or offer of a good conscience toward God by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Right, now, what's being said here? That the waters of the flood, which destroyed all living things, was actually a means of salvation for Noah and his family in the ark. So here, this destructive power was forced by the gracious will of God to preserve and protect these people in this motley vessel, right? And so that man does not glory in his power and accomplishments, but man rejoices in the grace of God that this rickety old boat, right, would actually not break up in pieces, but that God chose, you know, and the church often looks like a rickety old boat, doesn't it? You know, we Christians are often far less righteous and far less godly than we ought to be. The church is far less powerful in our society as it ought to be. And so just like the ark, you're going to be saved in that thing, huh? You know, just like the ark didn't look like it was up to the task, so it is that the church doesn't appear to be up to the task. But in baptism, great things are done to the people of God. And so we are saved in baptism. We have a good conscience toward God through the forgiveness of sins. And baptism is the fulfillment of the waters of the flood. All right.